Hey, Bill Johnson joins us. Bill, how are you today?
Good morning, sir. How are you?
We're very good. And Bill, you're a regular listener of our show. Is that correct?
Absolutely. My wife has been a Giants fan longer than she'd care to admit, and I went to Cal, and Giants have kind of been what we do.
Well, I love it. In fact, just a quick story. When I called you up to invite you on the show, you thought it was a prank call. You said, this can't be Marty Lurie calling.
I did. The voice was spot on, but I wasn't sure who was behind it.
Okay. All right. Very good. Hey, we're glad to have you on. And, of course, you've written before. You're a retired naval flight officer, and you've done many newspaper, magazine articles, and you've written a lot about baseball. But this book, Hal Troske, T-R-O-S-K-Y, got my attention because, number one, the name, which you'll explain, and number two, he was one of the forgotten stars of the 30s and early 40s, and you really went back and did a beautiful biography of him. So tell us a little bit why you chose him and a little bit of his background and why the book came about.
Absolutely. Like I said, my wife and her family are all huge baseball fans. I've got a great affinity for the game. It turned out, and I didn't realize this when I married her, but she was actually part of the larger extended Troske family. The more I learned, the more I realized I had access to some stuff about him that no one else had. And it just became kind of a natural extension of what I wanted to do, was to get the story out there, and get it a matter of the record, so that at least he had a little accounting in this huge history of baseball.
Well, you did it beautifully. And how did the Indians find him? Now, this is pre-draft, and I don't mean the war, but, the baseball draft, and he's in Iowa. How does someone even locate? Because there's always that romantic story of how they come and find somebody in those days.
Oh, absolutely. This is back in the era, literally, when the scouts were referred to often as ivory hunters. They were going to the stereotypical or mythological, I guess now, back towns, endless train stops, watching kids play. Every organization might only have a $50,000 a year budget for its entire scouting program for the nation, and then maybe some more money to sign players. It was a low-tech, lots of scouts looking. In Hal's case, He was an exceptionally good high school pitcher, and obviously a large human being. He was 6'2" at a time when most guys in high school were 5'10", and even baseball were 5'11". So he's a large man, great fastball, terrific hitter, and actually the scout from the Cardinals was the first guy that came to knocking on his door and actually offered him a contract to, in a sense, said, "We'll send you to Danville, Illinois." He thought about it for a second. The only person in his sphere that really knew anything about baseball was a guy named Bing Miller, who had played on Connie Mack's World Championship teams in 1929, 1930, kind of starred for them. And that was about 20 miles away, hops in the car, drives up to talk to Bing Miller. Bing Miller says, "Hey, if the Cardinals are interested, let me get a hold of Connie Mack and see if he'd be interested." All that's happening as a subtext when by the time Hal gets home literally that evening, he's got a guy named Cy Slapnicka, who is the Indians' primary scout for the entire Midwest and later ended up being the general manager, sitting at his dining room table with his father and an uncle. And he actually stuck a contract under his nose and said, "Now these guys are interested in you. We'd like you to go ahead and sign. We'll put you in Cedar Rapids right here next to home for your first year and see how it works out."
Wow, what a great story. Yeah, I love those stories of how they find people. Look at the great Bob Feller. As a sidelight, look at how they found him.
It was actually the same scout. Cy Slapnicka pretty much owned certainly Iowa. He was from Cedar Rapids, but he found Feller the same way and actually got into a little trouble with his contract later on, but that's a whole different story.
It sure is. All right, Bill Johnson is with us. The book is Hal Troske, T-R-O-S-K-Y. But he turns out to be a hell of a ball player. Talk a little bit about his career.
Troske is, and you asked before what motivated me to write the book. When you look at 1930s and early 1940s baseball, especially in the American League, that's this dominant era of the Yankees coming off the Athletics. And there's three first basemen that really stand out: Hank Greenberg, Jimmy Fox, and of course Lou Gehrig. Troske was in that league at that level. And he was the forgotten one because he played in Cleveland for a variety of other reasons. His star didn't shine quite as brightly. In 1934, his rookie season, he hit 35 homers, 206 hits. In 1936, he led the entire American League in total bases and runs batted in. He was a true slugging star. Connie Mack was on record in the papers saying he thought he was the next Ruth. And there were some reasons why that petered out later, but he was an outstanding player who, for a variety of reasons, never even truly made an All-Star team because of the level of talent against which he was competing.
Wow, very good. Good background on Hal Trotsky of the Cleveland Indians. That's pretty good to lead the league with those guys in the league at that point. Now, the name, and I must tell you, over the years when I saw the name, I always thought of Leon Trotsky because, of course, you know, what was going on in Russia and the assassination and all that. So how did he deal with that, and how did that impact his career and just his recognition in the world?
It's actually kind of ironic. I don't know if irony is the right word, but it's kind of funny because Hal's originally, his entire family were Czech Bohemian settlers. Their full name was Trojavsky, or spelled Trojavsky. And one of his friends and one of the Cleveland advisors said, hey, shorten this to Trotsky when you sign your first contract. And he did, and actually the rest of his family, except for a few, all shortened their names later in life. But really, Trotsky is just a contraction. 1940, and you alluded to this, that Leon Trotsky, at odds with Stalin, is expatriated, assassinated in Mexico. And I read several reports where after the assassination came on, the newscasters weren't sure, really, if it had been Hal Trotsky, the ballplayer, or Leon Trotsky, the communist, who had been killed. And there were apparently a couple of, I have not found them, but a couple of newspaper accounts and definitely some radio broadcasting and a lot of confusion, both among the communists and the Cleveland Indians fans.
Well, and as the world was in turmoil in those days, what was the effect on baseball, and especially for Hal Trotsky?
Oh, boy. The years leading up to, as Hitler's ascending in Europe, and many, many of the players were European and Eastern European immigrants or second-generation families, and had a lot of families back there, a lot of clubhouse attention just naturally turned that direction. You know, you hear the war drums in the distance, and I know it's a poor figure of speech, but it really was kind of the metronome for their life outside baseball. Discussion, the clubhouse would turn that way. The players became more and more concerned all the way up until the war started. And then, you know, there are many, many stories of ball players that just suspended their careers to go off and really, truly fight for the cause.
Was he in? Did he go in, or was he home? What happened with him?
Well, Hal was a different case. He tried to enlist. He tried three times. As soon as the war Pearl Harbor, each time the Army marked him as 4F. And you'd think, well, he's a professional athlete at the apex of his game. How could he be unqualified to carry a rifle? It turns out he had, starting in about 1938, he began to suffer truly, truly debilitating migraine headaches that doctors at the time could not pinpoint the cause. He reported those, and the Army kept saying, no, no, no. And finally, in 1942, said, absolutely not. It's not going to happen. He went on to, President Roosevelt at the time had issued what was called the worker fight dictum. And so you either were working in something productive or you were off fighting. And so he actually, his farming business, his off-season business as a farmer, at which he was quite talented, became his full-time line of work. And then he did some manufacturing work down at the Manor Refrigeration a few miles away.
Wow, Hal Trotsky. All right, let's look at the end of the career, the numbers, and where he sort of fits on the baseball landscape, in your opinion. How did it end up for him, the numbers, and where does he fit?
Yeah, 1941 was his last year with the Indians. Because of the headaches, he said the baseball started to look like a pile of white feathers coming toward him when he was taking throws from the pitcher, from a guy like Feller. That could knock you out. That could kill you. And he realized, and his wife, Lorraine, told him, you have to quit. And so he did. He came back in 1944 briefly. Jimmy Dykes, who had followed him, they were friends. He had signed him. And then 1945, the headaches came back. 1946, Hal played one more season. But by this time, this was the last year before Jackie Robinson and Larry Doby broke the color line. So the players had come back from World War II. The competition level was extremely high. So Hal finally decided, you know, I'm going to hang it up. They can't fix my migraines, which later turned out to be lactose related, which is ironic for an Iowa dairy farmer. But he finally gave it up and went home. And he was still relatively young. He was well before 40. I think he was 37 when he finally quit. As far as numbers, the Cleveland Indians, the fans and the team named him their all-time, their first baseman for their 20th century team for the first half of the last century. He still holds up. His 162 RBIs in 1936 is still the 20th best season ever. His lifetime batting average was over 300. Any other era in which he played, it's arguable that he would have been a much bigger star, even playing in Cleveland. But, you know, again, when you're competing against Fox, Gehrig, and Greenberg, there's really not much oxygen left to breathe.
Wow, very good. Very comprehensive story, and I enjoyed it and learning about it, especially the things that he had to overcome and being in the Midwest and, you know, not having all the publicity with those other guys around. So it's a McFarland book, of course, and where can one get it?
Yes, McFarland, terrific little company. It's available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the online outlets. But McFarland Direct also can take care of getting a copy. There, pretty much, if you want a copy, it's available online via online.
Yeah, McFarlandPub.com, McFarlandPub.com. And that is, look it up, Hal Trosky. William H. Johnson, Bill Johnson, is the author. And we have our book tree up here in Montclair, and I'm going to put this in, take it up there and show it to him and see if he can't get a couple of copies up there as well. Hey, I appreciate you being on, Bill. Congratulations. I'm glad you're a listener. And we have a good post game today. So tell your wife to tune in. And you guys, if you want to call in and talk Giants baseball, we welcome you at any time.
Well, thanks so much for reading. Thanks for this opportunity. And actually, we will be listening. So hope they do well.
Very good. Well, give us a call today. So we'll hear from you today if you have some time later on. We'll be on for a while. Thank you.
Sounds great. Thank you.
All right. That is Bill Johnson. How about that, Raph? Ended up with someone who wrote a book who listens to our show. He lives in Georgia and listens all the time. So interesting. You never know who you're going to run into in the baseball world. All right.